This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd. The U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday made Donald Trump the first U.S. president ever to be impeached twice, formally charging him with inciting an insurrection in a vote held a week after a violent mob of his supporters besieged the Capitol. AP's Sagar Meghani reports.
He must go.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi had urged colleagues to search their souls before the vote, accusing the president of inciting an armed mob to storm the Capitol last week and declaring him a clear and present danger. But with the nation reeling and the president due to leave in just a week, Republican Tom McClintock and others argued impeaching him now serves no purpose.
I cannot think of a more petty, vindictive, and gratuitous act.
Actually, removing the president from office before Joe Biden's inaugurated seems unlikely. Mitch McConnell's spokesman says the Senate GOP leader will not bring the Senate back early for a trial. When it happens, McConnell is not ruling out voting to convict the president. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
President Donald Trump has released a video condemning the violent insurrection he fomented in the Capitol last week. But as AP's Jackie Quinn reports, Trump did not mention the new impeachment charges against him.
There is never a justification for violence.
The newly impeached President Trump is calling for his supporters to find ways to ease tensions and calm tempers, and says he's been briefed about plans for more violence in the lead up to Joe Biden's inauguration.
There must be no violence, no law breaking, and no vandalism of any kind.
Trump made no mention of being impeached a second time, and his allies say they don't think the Senate would vote to convict. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
This is VOA News. Coronavirus cases and deaths continue to rise in some U.S. states as mass vaccination programs expand, AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Leaders of some Arizona hospitals say they may have to ration life-saving care. Dr. Marjorie Bessel at Banner Health says they're facing one of the worst infection rates in the country.
About 1 in 10 Arizonans is currently infected.
Bessel says staffing should not be an issue.
Healthcare workers have been vaccinated.
New York's Javits Center is open for mass vaccinations, but State Health Commissioner Howard Zucker says supply is a big issue.
We only get 300,000 doses each week from the federal government. And at that rate, it could take up to 6 months to vaccinate everyone currently eligible.
Supply is also an issue in California, but the state is immediately allowing people 65 and older to get the vaccines. I'm Ed Donahue.
Japan has expanded a coronavirus state of emergency for 7 more regions, affecting more than half the population amid a surge in infections across the country. AP's Charles de Ledesma has more.
The government is asking bars and restaurants in 7 prefectures to close by 8 p.m., employers to have 70% of their staff work from home, and residents in the affected areas to avoid going out for non-essential purposes. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga also says Japan will fully ban foreign visitors while the state of emergency is in place. Suga has been criticized as being too slow to act as the country's number of reported coronavirus infections and deaths roughly doubled over the past month to about 300,000 and 4,100. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The United States on Wednesday blacklisted 2 Iranian foundations controlled by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and their subsidies. The sanctions freeze any U.S. assets of those targeted and generally bar Americans from doing business with them. They are the latest to reinforce the maximum pressure campaign on Iran pursued by the Trump administration. Consumer prices have posted their biggest increase in 4 months, AP's Mike Hempen reports.
The Labor Department says consumer prices were up 0.4% in December. The increase was mainly due to a nearly 8.5% hike in gasoline prices. However, gas prices are still 15% lower than they were a year ago when people were still commuting to work. For all of 2020, inflation rose a modest 1.4%, below the Federal Reserve's target of 2%. Analysts believe inflation will remain low, with the U.S. economy still in a downturn from the coronavirus pandemic. Mike Hemp in Washington.
Be sure to log on to our website, voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Batte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandans are voting today, Thursday, in presidential and parliamentary elections.
We have been preparing for the general elections for quite some time, and we've made preparations along the way, executed several activities that were to prepare us for today, and right now we are on the D-Day, like you mentioned.
Meanwhile, Ugandans are stocking up on foodstuffs amid fears of possible election violence. The UN Security Council condemns rebel attacks on the Central African Republic capital. Aid groups warn of COVID-19 outbreak at an Ethiopian refugee camp in Sudan. And Ethiopia says its military killed three Tigray region officials, including a former Ethiopian foreign minister.
The state media is reporting that three senior former government officials and members of the TPLF have been killed today. One of them is a very prominent political figure, Mr. Siyum Mesfin, who served as a foreign minister.
And the ILO says poor working conditions for COVID-19 home workers must be improved. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandans are voting today, Thursday, in presidential and parliamentary elections. 76-year-old incumbent President Yoweri Museveni, in power for 35 years, is seeking another five-year term. His main challenger is 35-year-old Member of Parliament Robert Chakulahi, popularly known as Bobby Wine. The campaign has been marred by violence, mainly against opposition candidates and their supporters. Hours ahead of today's vote, the Ugandan Communication Commission ordered a shutdown of all social media networks and messaging applications. On the line from Kampala is Paul Bukenya, spokesperson for the Ugandan Electoral Commission. Good morning, Paul, and welcome to Daybreak Africa.
Thank you for inviting me to the program. I'm so glad to be here, and good morning to our listeners.
Thank you very much, Paul. And so today is D-Day. Ugandans are getting ready to vote. What preparations have your commission made for this day?
Well, we have been preparing for the general elections for quite some time, and we've made preparations along the way, executed several activities that were to prepare us for today. And right now, we are on the D-Day, like you mentioned. First of all, the National Voters Register is ready. It was compiled and cleaned up with the involvement of the people. Public, and now we have 18.1 million registered voters on our register who are going to vote. The polling stations, 34,684 polling stations scattered around the different parts of this country are ready for the elections. Then we did produce voting materials, ballot papers, which have now been delivered to all the districts and brought up to the stations in time for voting. Of course, besides that, we nominated candidates who have been canvassing and going around the country in a modified way because of COVID-19, asking and seeking the support of the people. Officials for the polling stations have been recruited and trained and deployed, as well as security arrangements, working with police to ensure that the environment enables voters to come out and vote peacefully.
Paul, talking about the environment, do you think the Ugandan people have been educated enough in terms of their choices? Do you think the candidates have had enough time to inform the voters about their policies?
Yeah, I think that has happened because the build-up has been over a period of time. It's not just the other day, but over a period of time. First of all, after the program was released, the aspiring candidates coming up, and then after the nominations in November. So there's been more than 2 months of campaigns and outreach through different platforms and medium to the voters. Of course, before that, we also had political activity and the general knowledge of elections every 5 years. So we think the population has gotten to know the candidates at both presidential, parliamentary, and local government. And they will turn up to vote for the candidates of their choice today.
Some Ugandans were very concerned about the possibility of violence. What measures do you think the commission has put in place?
Yeah, I think in the course of the campaign, we did see some issues coming up, like confrontations that came up in some of the occasions, especially during enforcement of COVID-19 standard operating procedures concerning especially gatherings, which are prohibited, large gatherings of more than 200 people. But also the incidents that we saw sometime in November that went really very ugly. All those are issues that came up, but they could be put in a context and seen as things that have been addressed And we will not see a recurrence of them coming up again during the elections, because I think we both, the stakeholders, we as Electoral Commission, kept engaging stakeholders, including the candidates and their supporters, as well as educating the public to ensure that they build and support a peaceful exercise.
You know, Paul, I asked that question because some of the opposition candidates have said that the commission has been one-sided when it comes to enforcing COVID-19 regulations and campaigning. They think that the commission has favored the ruling NRM and President Museveni.
Well, the ruling NRM has complained because when we suspend campaigns in several districts across the country as a measure to prevent a risk of spread of COVID-19, they raised that they have candidates all over the country being a mass party and raised a serious objection to that. But we told them that it's in the public interest. It's about health and nothing else. You can use other non-contact means. So we've not turned a blind eye on any of the candidates. What we've seen is a treatment that has gone and cut across all candidates.
Paul, thank you very much again, and good luck on election day today, Thursday.
Thank you, and I wish you well as well.
Paul Bukenya is the spokesperson for the Uganda Electoral Commission. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. Some Ugandans have engaged in panic buying, stocking up on foodstuffs like rice, maize flour, beans, and other essential items amid fears about possible violence linked to the election. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The campaign has been wrecked by deadly attacks and chaotic scenes, leaving many feeling uncertain about today's balloting and where a painful aftermath may follow. A heavy security presence has been deployed to parts of the capital, Kampala. The military is patrolling the surrounding area, and some soldiers have been deployed to points with views of strategic areas. Steven Sempala is among those who were spotted stocking up.
Bought some food. I have heard from so many people who are rushing into the market to buy posho, to buy beans, to buy food items that can last longer in anticipation of violence.
City traders were torn between closing their businesses or staying open to make a little more money amid uncertainties on how the next few weeks will play out. With memories of chaos in November still fresh, many are convinced that there will be violence in the capital, as some people might take advantage of the election events. Kenneth Ayebade is a Ugandan trader.
Most of the traders have held on to their money because they don't know what next. Even those that we have their goods in China still say don't load. Those that have containers that have reached Mombasa, mainly beginning of this week, they still say, wait, I will tell you. Even those that have goods that are here, the activities have slowed down basically.
President Yoweri Museveni, who has been in power nearly 35 years, longer than most of the population has been alive, is seeking another term in office. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The United Nations Security Council has condemned rebel attacks on the Central African Republic capital, Bangui, resulting in the death of a Rwandan peacekeeper. In a statement on Wednesday, the council took note of the country's December 27th presidential election results proclaimed by the National Elections Authority on January 4, 2021, and called on all political actors to resolve any electoral disputes peacefully and in accordance with the laws and constitution of the Central African Republic. The council also condemned attacks against humanitarian workers and members of the UN peacekeeping mission in the Central African Republic, also known as MINUSCA. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 14. Ethiopia said Wednesday that its military killed three members of the Tigray region's former ruling party, including former Ethiopian Foreign Minister Seyoum Mesfin. The government's task force on the Tigray crisis said on Twitter that the three Tigray People's Liberation Front TPLF officials were killed after they refused to surrender to the military. Dr. Masimbet Asefa is the assistant professor of law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law.
The state media is reporting that three senior former government officials and members of the TPLF that defected and that attacked the northern base have been killed today. So one of them is a very prominent political figure, Mr. Seyoum Mesfin, who served as a foreign minister for Ethiopia before the political transition, before Abiy came into power. So that's the news, the big news coming here in Ethiopia today. The two officials are Asmellash Woldeslase, a very senior also inner circle of the TPLF, and also Abai Zahaye, another member of the senior political leadership of TPLF.
The report says that the former foreign minister and others refused to surrender. What side was this former foreign minister on? Was he part of the TPLF? Because he was former foreign minister.
James, it makes it very tragic in a sense because, I mean, for someone that has served, by the way, I think if I'm not mistaken, he should be the longest serving foreign minister in Ethiopia. He has been very active also in foreign missions, in mediation processes in South Sudan, in many other places. He had a very prominent place in the diplomatic circle as well. So that makes it very tragic, you know. So even if there are political differences between the Abiy's administration and the TPLF, you would think for someone who has served at a regional level, even at a very international level, that they would at least sidestep from political confrontations between parties. But apparently he sided within the TPLF, and the rift became stronger between Abiy and the TPLF circle, as you know. And he was one of the leaders involved also in the attacks against the northern base, and obviously chose to be within the defecting group in the TPLF. That makes it very tragic. And as you said, the military spokesperson that's briefed regarding the killing, it's not only the killing of the three senior political officers of the TPLF, but others have been also captured. Very senior military officials have been captured. So what the spokesperson for the military said today is that the three individuals, including Seyoum Mesfin, the foreign minister, were asked actually to surrender. They refused, and action was taken, and they were killed in action.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed declared victory, that the conflict was over. What does this mean? Does this mean the TPLF is continuing to fight on?
It cannot, because I have said this also, I think, during our previous conversation. You know, for any kind of, let's say, guerrilla warfare and military engagement to continue, there should be some moral ground in which you can actually galvanize public action for whatever purpose you want to do. So, you know, when the people of Tigray did that during the Derg regime, obviously it was a very brutal military dictatorship. They co-opted with other groups in terms of overthrowing the Mengistu Haile Mariam's regime at that time. But Abiy's political position, however political predicament that he has, it's very difficult to justify war on Abiy's government currently and the reforms that are undertaken in Ethiopia. So it's true what you said. In after 3 weeks of military engagement, conventional war was over when the capital city in Tigray, Mekelle, was occupied by Ethiopian defense forces. That is, I think, very clear. So what you see now is that other kinds of sporadic military engagement in the countryside in Tigray region, where they have been hiding. So I think 2 days ago, another senior, almost a kind of kingmaker of the TPLF, Sabahat Nega, was also captured. I see this as a culmination of actually the military engagement rather than a continuation of the insurrection, because the talk of war, guerrilla warfare, cannot be sustainable in Tigray, both on moral grounds and on a military and security grounds.
Thank you so much again, Doc. We so appreciate very much speaking with you always. Thank you.
Thank you, James, for the opportunity.
Dr. Masembet Asefa is the Assistant Professor of Law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law. He was speaking with us from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. 8 workers this week confirmed several cases of COVID-19 in Sudan's camps for refugees who fled the fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The United Nations Refugee Agency and the aid group Mercy Corps say an urgent intervention is needed to avoid a humanitarian disaster. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
Aid organizations reported 4 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Sudan's Umm Rakuba camp for Ethiopian refugees this week. The camp houses 25,000 people who have arrived since November, living in very basic overcrowded conditions that present an opportunity for the coronavirus to easily spread. Mercy Corps is running a health clinic in the Umm Rakuba camp and has treated nearly 5,000 refugees. The group's regional director, Sean Granville-Ross, called for a swift and decisive action to prevent further spread of the virus.
It's really a matter of grave concern for all of us, given the conditions of the camp, the vulnerability of the people, the population density, which makes social distancing very difficult, and the lack of materials, PPE and equipment to enable us to really manage this outbreak and take care of the people.
The four people confirmed to have COVID-19 have been quarantined, says UNHCR officer Giulia Raffaelli.
Confirmed positive cases undergo isolation and upon contact tracing, primary contact pending their test results. More activities are being set up, such as communication with communities and the realization of isolation centers, and more funding is needed in order to ramp up the response.
Sudanese authorities received aid from UAE and other Arab countries to help the Ethiopian refugees in December. Health observers say more money is needed due to the increasing influx and the growing risk of COVID-19. Sudan has registered more than 23,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 since late October, with more than 2,000 deaths. Meanwhile, Sudan's government and aid organizations have finished preparations to move the refugees to a new camp west of Al-Qadarif. The government says the move will take refugees away from the tense border area and improve security. Naba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Human Rights Watch says most countries globally did not respect the rights of their people in 2020. In its annual report, the group names the United States as one of the countries that also violated the rights of its people. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, the rights group says African countries that held elections used the COVID-19 pandemic as an excuse to abuse the rights of their people.
Citing examples of the African countries that recently held elections and Uganda that is holding its general election today, Thursday, Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth said that most presidents use the COVID-19 pandemic as an excuse to oppress the opposition and those who are criticizing how the respective governments run its affairs.
Many governments seized upon the pandemic as the latest excuse to entrench their power and to suppress opposition. And we saw this, you know, with Viktor Orban in Hungary, who, you know, immediately declared dictatorial powers, the power to rule by decree without parliament, because he was going to be the great savior with respect to the pandemic. Uganda has a big election for president and parliament. President Museveni has used the pandemic as an excuse to quash the political rallies of his principal opponent, Bobi Wine, while allowing his rallies to go forward. You know, these kinds of pretextual uses of the pandemic have been quite common.
The Human Rights Watch World Report 2021 that reviews development in more than 100 countries also strived to persuade governments and international institutions to curb abuses and promote human rights. Mr. Roth said that some of the countries have imprisoned healthcare workers who questioned the government about their safety at workplace.
One thing we've learned is that public health requires the free flow of information and freedom to criticize the government's response in order to correct it and move it in a more productive direction. And so an example where this has all gone wrong is in Egypt, where President Sisi has imprisoned doctors who criticize his poor response to the pandemic, with the result that he continues to shovel money at the army, his main backers, neglecting Egyptian hospitals.
The Human Rights Watch has, however, blamed the United States of America for violating the basic rights of its people in what they call white supremacy. The executive director, U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, Nicole Austin, said that they have highlighted the recommendations that the incoming regime should put into consideration.
We're also calling for the Biden administration to look at ways that we can provide more equitable educational opportunities. We've seen in the era of COVID that disparities have really shown themselves with respect to how at-home schooling and education has impacted Black and Brown communities in a very disparate way. We want to see more equality and a leveling of the playing field when it comes to those issues. So yes, we will continue to push the Biden administration in all of those key areas. And we think that will go a long way to helping to address the systemic racism that exists in the United States.
In Kenya, the Kenya police has been faulted for violating the rights of the people while ensuring order during the dusk to dawn curfew hours. According to the report, there are many serious human rights violations that Human Rights Watch simply lacks the capacity to address. Other issues addressed in the report were inequality, climate change, and racism in the U.S. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
The International Labour Organization says millions of people forced to work at home because of the coronavirus pandemic labour under poor and exploitative conditions. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Prior to the pandemic, an estimated 260 million people, representing 7.9% of global employment, worked from home. The International Labor Organization expects this number now to be substantially higher. The ILO says problems affecting workers often are invisible because they occur within the privacy of their own homes. The report finds home workers in low and middle income countries are most at risk. It notes about 90% work informally within the confines of their homes. They produce goods that cannot be automated, such as garments, handicrafts, and assemble electronic items. ILO senior economist and an author of the report, Janine Berg, tells VOA people churning out these traditional industrial products are unaccounted and easily exploitable.
They don't have social protection coverage. They're more likely to suffer occupational safety and health risks. Some people are working with shoe glue, or they're working in unsafe positions, for example, that can cause musculoskeletal disorders. Their earnings are below the minimum wage. The working hours are very hard to predict. You know, sometimes they have periods of very intense work, and sometimes they have periods of no work. So there's all this kind of instability.
In the global north, the report finds an increasing number of white-collar professionals working from home. They include teleworkers and home-based digital platform workers. Berg says they are usually worse off than those who work outside the home.
Again, you're working from home, you have these challenges of social isolation, and then there's risks over time of a deterioration in working conditions, even if you are a professional white-collar worker. And also, because you're at home, you're less likely to be part of a trade union, you're less likely to have that kind of voice and dialogue that you would with management to kind of address some of these limitations in working conditions.
The ILO report says higher skilled professionals earn less on average than people working in an office. For example, it notes those working remotely earn on average 13% less in Britain, 22% less in the United States, and about 50% in India. The ILO expects home working will continue to expand in post-COVID years. It says laws to better protect home workers must be enacted. It recommends the establishment of a labor registry of home workers and a system for monitoring their working conditions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Thursday, January 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.